Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with your host, Pete Talbot, along with Dr. Samara Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you an opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here's your host of Leading Edge Medicine, Pete Talbot.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. I hope this is going to be a better hour than our first hour earlier today.
Well, the hour was great. Just that the radio transmitters weren't working.
Well, so. They put in new equipment. It doesn't matter. We're here. We're at 570 KVI. God bless them. We've been on the air at we started in
1999, 22 years.
You started your practice, Longevity Medical Clinic, in 1998.
Yep.
You and I ran into each other. You called me in mid-1999.
And said, help, I'm going broke.
Oh, my golly. And we've been putting up with each other ever since.
Yep.
And we got you on the air just a few months later.
Yes. And I've always been grateful. You know, Rush Limbaugh ran the show before us. And I've always thought it was very nice of Mr. Limbaugh to kind of warm up the audience before the real show started.
That's right.
And so
That was back then when Rush was on 570 KVI. And God bless him, of course, as he passed just this last week. Oh, my golly. What an amazing
He had a great journey, though. He had a great journey.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. So here we are today, and I am happy to say we're starting off with Dr. Michael Gilbert.
Good morning.
We actually had you for the last 45 minutes, so.
It's already been fun.
It's already been fun. That's right. So I'm going to give out the phone number, the toll-free phone number. We've had technical difficulties earlier, and we're going to use the KVI toll-free number. I think down the track, we're going to revert to our other new number, but I'm not going to, it's a little too confusing for today. 1-888-312-5757. 1-888-312-5757. Dr. Michael Gilbert with Northwest Vision Institute. I've actually got a couple of email questions for you. People didn't want to go on the air, what have you, last hour, so I'll ask you those in a moment or
Great.
Two. But more importantly, first come, first served, as far as I'm concerned. When people call in, they take priority
Absolutely.
Over those that are too nervous about being on the air.
That's the most fun.
It is the most fun. It's the best radio, and it's the most help at 1-888-312-5757. So while we wait for some calls, and by the way, you can call for Dr. Mixon, too.
You can. I'm here.
You know, obviously. So anything goes here. It's just that for the next hour, we've got Dr. Michael Gilbert. Okay, so here we go. You started off earlier today talking about masculinity, testosterone, fertility, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I think this audience badly needs to hear that information.
I think all of America and Europe
yes.
needs to hear this.
Yes.
You know, the sperm count and the testosterone level in Europe and America are dropping in tandem. Since 1976, testosterone and sperm counts have been dropping at 1 to 1.2% per year. A young man today has about a 25% lower testosterone level and sperm count than his father had at the same age.
When you say a younger man, like 20s,
25, 30s?
30. Okay.
And he has about half the testosterone and sperm count that his grandfather had at the same age. That's terrifying. You know, when I was in medical school 40 some years ago, we were taught the average sperm count in a man was about 200 million sperm per cc. It's down to about 114 now. That is a real problem because we are getting more and more infertility. Used to be infertility was primarily a woman's issue. Now it is equally a man's issue because men are not making as much sperm as they used to make. And men don't have the testosterone load they used to make. Compared to a man in 1976, a young man of the same age today is 59% lower in testosterone load than his grandfather. That's not good. That's really not good. There is a generational bias to always, you know, diss the younger generation.
Yeah.
You know, what are these kids coming to, sort of?
A bunch of wimpy crybabies.
But it turns out that when you look at the numbers, we really do have a younger generation that is wussier than their fathers and grandfathers.
Well, that also then
that's
makes...
That's really kind of spooky.
Then those of us who are getting older are even... because normally those counts drop anyway.
Yes.
So that lack of masculinity in older age is even worse than it used to be.
Well, except that the older age had good levels when they were young.
Okay.
They're low now because the guy is old. That's you know, acceptable, I guess, except for me. I won't accept it, but I carry the levels of a healthy 25-year-old in the 70s.
And that's what Longevity Medical Clinic, for crying out loud, is all about.
Yes,
but my point is, these younger people, the millennials and what have you, as they get older, their wimpiness is going to be even more exaggerated in their old age.
Yeah, he's a wuss now, and in 30 years, he will be pathetic.
I fear we may lose a few people for the political incorrectness. But I will tell you, when I have seen this data, which I view as a biologic concern.
It is.
Right? Because where is this headed? And while I remember the data, I have forgotten the theories as to why. So I know that's going to be the next piece, right?
Well, theories, but that's what we are. We don't have reasons. We have theories.
Maybe that's why I haven't retained it, because I wasn't persuaded.
No.
I haven't been persuaded on the reason.
We've got everything from hormones in the milk and so on that we're feeding to our children. We've got dietary concerns. We've got lack of exercise and too much time sitting. We've got plasticizers in the environment. There's a lot of potential reasons. But one of the things that scares me the most are some studies that were done back from the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, over a 30-some-year period by a doctor. I'm trying to remember his name, Cartwright or Carthage. Anyway, he published a series of papers back through that time, over a 30-year period, over what he referred to as his mousetopias. And what he did was he started off in just one room, and he built this room to be a utopia for mice. Had ground corn cobs and paper all over the floors. He had shelves. He had adequate food and water. In fact, he had robust amounts of everything they would need. He put breeding pairs in there, and they bred, and they got to be a lot of mice in the room. But as the population grew, at some point in this stress-free, all-you-can-eat, all-you-want-in-life environment, they started getting neurotic. And the old stopped teaching the young to burrow. And instead of digging tunnels, they started just rolling things up in balls. And the females stopped associating with the males, and they retreated away from the male mice. And the male mice stopped pursuing the females. And the population began to drop. And eventually, they went extinct. They just died off. There were no surviving mice.
Affluence.
Affluence, with all they had and nothing to strive for.
That's scary. How many generations?
Well, I don't remember. I read these papers long ago. But he did this thinking, well, it was just this type of mice. So he did it with a different varieties of mice. He did it with rats. He did it not just in a room. He eventually went out and bought a barn and got a grant and built multiple layers. So they had enormous amount of space. And again, every breed of mouse and rats, when they reached a certain population with total affluence and nothing to strive for, stopped breeding and went extinct. Now, the reason I bring these old studies up with rodents instead of people is that in every affluent Western and European society, population reproduction has dropped below replacement values. College-educated affluent Americans stopped having enough babies to replace themselves in 1967, and it has dropped every decade since.
Right. Wow.
And now it's the entire population of America and of Europe is not having enough babies to replace themselves. Some the Scandinavian countries have been giving bounties for 20-some years. If you'll please have a baby, we'll pay you to get pregnant. In America, all of our growth has been from immigration, not from having our own babies. And the only people in America having enough babies to replace themselves are first-generation immigrants and their children. By the time you get out to the second generation, they've acculturated to American affluence and are not having enough children to replace themselves. What worries me in this dropping testosterone, dropping fertility, dropping birth rate is it mirrors to a frightening degree what happened in the rodents.
The rats.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you know, this is, so in essence, affluence is there was no stress, no challenge,
nothing to strive for. They got neurotic, and the males stopped acting male, and the females stopped acting provocative females, and they basically became neutered. And in America today and in parts of Europe, we are now seeing this whole thing. Am I male? Am I female? Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm different today than I will be tomorrow. And, you know, we get this whole gender dysphoria, this whole am I male or not? What is a male? Is being male a toxic? Should we stamp out masculinity in America? Well, that's happening because the testosterone levels are dropping to kiddie levels anyway. Yeah, it's kind of spooky.
So we don't have time to go into all of this, but Dr. Fred Marker did a study. This is a guy who was an atheist, a communist, a trainer, an activist trainer in Russia back, I believe, in the 40s or 50s, 50s, I guess. In any event, he had a religious experience. It doesn't matter. He left that whole system and he became a historian and he studied the 26 previous superpowers. And he, again, they can't go into, he basically says there are six stages of superpowers. Obviously the foundation and boom, 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 boom. Well, the final stage, he says, he calls, you can call it whatever you want, but he calls it decadence is the final stage. He believes we are in that final stage as a superpower. And he says, unfortunately, once a superpower gets into that final stage, It never reverses. It always crashes and burns.
Well, going back to the mousetopias for a minute. In the 60s, the fear was overpopulation. What we were all terrified of in the 1960s we were going to run out of resources. Everybody was going to starve. We were all going to freeze to death in the cold because the ice age was coming back. It wasn't global warming. It was global cooling in those days that we were all afraid of. And
I remember Leonard Nimoy on a Nova or some special show on PBS saying, we're going to freeze to death.
Yeah, it was on the front page of Time magazine. You know, the ice age is coming.
Yeah.
But the point is, we were afraid of running out of resources. We had reached peak oil. There wasn't going to be enough oil to keep us warm in the coming ice ages, and we were all over concerned. Thing that we thought was going to do it was overpopulation.
Yeah.
But I'd point out in the mouse studies, when he drew his initial conclusions, he said, look what overpopulation does. But when they stopped having babies, overpopulation wasn't the problem. The population was declining.
Mm.
And once it started going down, they were no longer overpopulated, but they did not return to healthy behaviors.
The surprise is that it doesn't reach a steady state.
Yes.
Right. You would expect, I mean, if I had reached maximum, we'll reach a steady state for the resources and the environment.
Sure.
Instead, you see further decline way beyond that.
And they had all the resources they need. But as long as, once this decline started, it just continued. And they went down and down and down, and they were no longer overpopulated. They were clearly underpopulated, and they finally went extinct because there just weren't enough.
Interesting. So it's more than just...
So it's not just overpopulation.
Yeah.
There's something about those mice having everything they needed with nothing to strive for that appeared to destroy them.
Yeah, affluence.
Affluence.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's a relationship between what I was illustrating with the stage of decadence, you know, where we have everything we need, but there seems to be...
Yeah. Well, again, decadence is, on one hand, a value judgment.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So it's not an objective measurable. It's a value judgment. We've said these people are now, you know... But the numbers don't lie.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing in our society and what they're seeing in Europe. And, of course, China has made it even worse for themselves. In 1976, they passed the one child per family issue.
Right.
And they tended to abort their girls because every Chinese family wanted a boy. That's how my wife got her name, Bandine, which means half boy, because everybody knew that a girl was only half as good as a boy. So her father named her half boy.
Oh, boy.
What a jerk. Anyway. they now have an aging population, and they don't have babies. In fact, they now have passed a new law saying you can have two kids, but people aren't. They're less than one child per family.
Serious?
0.7 something child per family.
So what?
The population of China will be dropping like a stone, and Chinese men, because they aborted the girls in my wife's generation, they're going to Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam to import wives because
of course
there are men and no women to go around.
Oh, this is so weird. The wimpifying of America.
The wimpifying of the Western world.
Okay,
it's not just America.
And not just the Western world.
Yes, right. But even Asia, because they really screwed up.
Yes.
They did it to themselves.
They kind of kicked the process into high gear.
The problem. Yes. Holy cow. Wow. So, okay.
So as a businessman?
Yes.
What I'm saying is I need a version of a longevity medical clinic for all those guys in their 20s and 30s.
Right.
And their hypomasculinity.
So now our...
Your challenge, though, is to educate the market because
the
culture from the government on down is telling us this is the way we should be.
That's right. Yes. Right. A man is supposed to be a woman with a penis. That's the ideal man today.
And shouldn't talk about it.
That's right.
Wow. Talk about awkward. Yes. Very, very strange.
But, you know,
honestly, Jerry, this is what longevity is here and how we can help people.
And I have said for a generation, that I am unashamedly male, and some folks don't seem to like that. That's too damn bad. Reality is males are 50% of the population. Our drives, ambitions, instincts, desires are every bit as normal as females. There's no reason that any man should be embarrassed or ashamed of what he thinks and feels and wants, because it is every bit as natural as the women's. We're equal. Okay? We have every much as right to our feelings
to
and desires and instincts as women do to theirs.
To be womanly.
Yes.
Wow. Boy, you're going to be canceled here.
Yes, that's right. Welcome to Tradition Radio.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But again, Jerry, this is what's so exciting. most young men are not going to become into longevity, even though in a perfect world, wouldn't that be wonderful? But
yep.
We have people start coming to us right around 40, 45, and it's a pretty even spread, real heavy between, like, say, 45 and 80. Because is it ever too late for people to come to longevity?
No.
We hear people ask, they call on the radio and says, well, could my dad is 75, is he too old?
Well, if he's in hospice care, probably.
Well, okay.
But short of hospice care, I'd say we can probably help to some degree.
And testosterone, for example, is one of many hormones.
But you know what I want to know, yes, we have documented a progressive decline in testosterone levels. What no one has looked at, and what I really, really, really would like to get hold of a bunch of young guys and run their assays and say, where's their pregnenolone, the dehydroepiandrosterone? Where's their estradiol? Where's their progesterone? Where is this whole panel of hormones, these eight different things that we look at in our older guys, where are they in the young guys?
Are they also changing?
Yes, because I doubt very seriously it's just testosterone.
No, of course.
Yeah. If that is going down, so are other things, and we need to be looking at the entire picture.
All right, just one more reason, in fact, a huge, monstrous reason, why you don't want to get older and continue the wimpifying, the demasculinization. Is that a word?
It is now.
It is now. So come on in. Make a free health analysis appointment. For crying out loud, there are things you can do. And we still do the two free tests, the blood test and the special in-body test. Combined, those two tests will help give you some basic understandings as to what is happening in your body, your aging process. If you don't measure, you don't know. So come on in. Let us do those two free tests for you. We also give you, just for coming to the appointment, $100 of free longevity supplements. So lots of reasons for you to take that first baby step so you can start dealing with these many, many issues.
And guess what, guys?
Guess what?
You heard that the one-eyed man in the land of the blind is king.
Yeah.
A real man in a wussy world is also king.
You know, there's some real truth to that. There's some real truth to that.
Yep.
Let's not settle for just falling apart on schedule. The statistics are not good.
No, they're not.
And it doesn't have to be. Don't have that fatalistic attitude that you're just going to fade off. You're going to lose your warrior-like masculinity. Just because you're getting older, it does not have to be. And it's a sad, sad, sad way to end your life. Your final chapters, just being...
Yep.
Oh, my God.
But I think perhaps the more important takeaway is not just that end-of-life question, but if I'm listening to this radio program and I'm in my 20s, 30s, I'm beginning to think, wonder what my levels are.
Yeah.
And your primary care physician is never going to raise this issue.
And if he does check, he'll only check testosterone.
Oh, that's right.
And he won't check all of the other things that are also important.
And you'd have to come up with complaints that you're not going to voice in order to get that test
right.
taken. So unless you follow this in a different way, and we all know what that way is that we've been discussing, is you're going to not know. If you don't measure, you're not going to know that you're Absolutely. Part of that decline.
Yep.
And he'll tell you, hey, you're just normal. You're just normal for your age.
Right.
What a lousy, rotten ruler that is.
Yes,
disgusting.
Is.
Okay. Again, you make your free health analysis appointment by going to lmclinic.com. You do it online. At least 95% of you will. lmclinic.com. You get the two free tests. You get $100 of free longevity supplements. And you get to find out what your basic health risks are. You need to know that so you can plan for your future. Don't be fatalistic. It's completely the wrong step to take. Go to lmclinic.com. Okay, we got to go to a call here. Let us go to Buckley and talk with Charlie. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good.
Morning, Charlie.
Good morning. I know I have a question for Dr. Gilbert, but first, for Dr. Nixon, through the years, I've seen some very virile men, and it seems like they get, I don't know, like in their 50s or something, and all of a sudden they get kind of effeminate.
Yep.
Yes.
You do. Well, yeah, and that is part of course, what we look at. If you were in my generation in the 1970s and you were 20 years old, I would expect a total testosterone level on you up around 1,200. And by the time that same guy hits 60, it's down around 250 or 300.
So from 1,200 to 200 or 300.
Yeah.
Whoa.
That's a typical drop between 20 and 60.
Wow.
So it's a big fall. And, you know, IGF-1 growth hormone levels have usually declined from about 200 or 250 down to around 90 to 110.
My goodness.
Okay. Pregnenolone levels have dropped from 80 or 90 down to 20, 25. Dehydroepiandrosterone levels have dropped from 400 or 500 down to 125, 130. So all of these anabolic hormones, all of these things involved in healing and growth and development and bone and muscle and brain are all falling down. And as they decline, we decline with them. And that's why we don't use those normative values at longevity. We use the middle of a healthy 25 to 30-year-old as our target.
I see.
So
I was wondering if it's something in our food that they're giving us, in the last couple of decades.
No, what you're describing is just it's aging. You got to remember, human beings, biology doesn't care about our desires, our philosophy, our religion, our ethos. Biology knows reproduction and survival of the species, not the individual. Okay.
Sure.
We are designed to have our highest sex drive, our desire to reproduce, when we're in our teens. And for most of human history, that's when we had our babies. We have created this artificial thing called adolescence, in which when people's drives are the highest, we tell them, no, you have to wait. Okay? And I understand it's a good thing from a social economic standpoint, but it is counter biology. And then if you had your kids in your teens, you would stay strong and durable long enough to protect them until they could have their babies. And at that point, you would be in your 30s. Okay? That's when you start going downhill. Once your kids are capable of having kids, you've done your job. From a biological standpoint, your job is to get slow, weak, fat, die, get out of the way, quit consuming resources the next generation needs. The problem with that plan is we don't like it. We don't want to cooperate with it. Right? So longevity's whole function is to say, you know, that's normal's great if you're 18 years old. By 50, normal stinks. And I don't want to be normal. I'm 73 years old. Okay. I run 3.5 to 4 miles in, you know, 30 to 40 minutes. I bench press 220 pounds. I'm married to a woman 30 years my junior. I'm one of the few guys in his mid 70s with an 8-year-old daughter at home. Okay.
Right.
I will not accept being normal for my age. Okay. I enjoy functioning like a stronger, faster, younger, in many respects, more virile male. You
know? Same here.
My wife would be appalled to share her bed with a guy with a great big fat flabby belly. She wants a husband who is lean and hard and strong and masculine. But then she is 30 years my junior.
And with that, I'll take 5 seconds to say, go to lmclinic.com, folks. Make a free health analysis appointment. But now you have a question, Charlie, for Dr. Gilbert.
I'm sure it won't be quite as exciting as the...
Well,
I tend to bring less sex into my my ophthalmic analysis, but I'll try and make it a little more racy for the audience.
Sure. Sure, sure. Well, yeah,
what's the question?
A while back, you were on the show, and you mentioned about maybe a big warehouse or such and such, and that a lot of them, you're actually going to an optometrist, and they don't really do the alignment correctly with a prescription.
Are you wanting me to comment on that and get into trouble again?
Well, no. I don't want you to comment about that. But the thing is, so I make an appointment. It took almost three months. Finally, we see the optometrist and the wife. And all of a sudden, he goes, hey, you got a blood clot behind your right retina. And I go, oh, no, you know. And it's like, so that starts the ball, you know, rolling with the vascular, the cardiac, and, you know, you know what I mean, her three different professionals and, of course, the primary doctor and all that. And so, I did not, because he said that. He's not going any further about, even though he mentioned the doing the glaucoma and doing new lenses and all that. But the main concern was her blood clot. So anyway,
of course,
I skipped the alignment deal. You know, that's the reason I was going there.
Sure. So once the acute treatment is stabilized, which would be the, you know, if there's any retinal damage, obviously that needs to be taken care of. But then you want to look at what could cause such an occlusion, whatever exactly it was. So you want to look at both of those. Once that's stable, then we have to get back to the general eye care. And if there are alignment issues, obviously that can't be neglected. There's a long list of things. We try and approach all of those at the same time. But there's no question you have to prioritize. Any vascular problem could have systemic implications. Eye is supplied by microvasculature, the same as the brain. So anything that could block a microvessel in the eye could as easily take out the microvasculature in the brain. So, you know, when you have a blockage in the retina is neural tissue, just as the cerebellum or other parts of the brain. So it's a microstroke. And at least that's a good way to think about it in terms of the implications to the whole body. So I think prioritizing how you respond to it is exactly appropriate. But it sounds like if that's now stable, it's time to get back to your vision and what brought you in.
And his question was also, if I'm not mistaken, Charlie, going to the big box store or the warehouse or talking, we all know who he's talking about. Does that make sense? I know that you warned me just as a friend because I had a relative that I mentioned, oh, I'm so sorry, this guy just went to Costco to get it. Oh, I said it. I didn't mean to
shame
say
on
Costco.
You.
But anyway, going to Costco.
Your stock just went down.
I know. Anyway, and you had a small coronary right there on behalf of my relative. That unwisely was headed there.
So I think it's in my practice. I have a number of physicians who work with me, ophthalmologists and optometrists. We work as a team, and much as the longevity clinic, we frequently meet and we're always talking. You know, and just as you have different level providers, there is a richness that's brought to the way you deliver care when you have people with different training coming together and sharing their expertise.
Absolutely.
I learn from my retina specialist every day. And I know he complains when he's dealing with anterior segment issues that he's wishing, you know, could you help me with this? So we're all feeding each other. When you are a solo practitioner with limited experience with pathology, which is typically the case when you've chosen a job where you're measuring for glasses and screening for eye disease in a warehouse store, you're not going there because you have a rich experience of dealing with sick eyes. You have a rich experience with dealing with healthy eyes. And I don't, you know, I can't speak to some, there's going to be a variety of, there's going to be a range of experience and training. But if you're concerned that you might have a subtle condition, the likelihood that it'll be picked up with someone whose training is predominantly well eyes instead of predominantly patients who have sicker eyes. The people who, you know, ophthalmologists are predominantly trained with, you know, 4 years of four years, depending on the specialty, of treating the sickest possible eyes. So you're going to pick up those changes early. So that's my point. And then having any prescription that you might have, and I think you were alluding to this as well, having any prescription that you might have done at the optical at some of those warehouse stores, they're built on volume. And I can't tell you the percentage of patients who come to me and say, my glasses aren't working. I can't read with them. It's most usually I can't read with them. And the mistake that's often made is they don't seem to understand that the positioning of the reading component of the technology has to be aligned with the patient's range of physical view. They pick some frame that looks good on them and slap the lenses in and say good luck. And the patient goes out with a smile, believing that they've saved a nickel. Unfortunately, the function of the glasses often is inferior. That was my only point, and I'm sorry that I brought it up again.
No, you didn't. I did, or he did, or not you.
But you're going to hear the rest of the story. So,
oh dear.
Anyway, I looked at this prescription, and you know they had a prism area there, and I believe I looked it up, and I said, well, that's alignment. Well, the thing is, in the meantime, she goes to the cardiologist, and the cardiologist says, oh, you're taking Eliquis. You can't even have a blood clot. Okay? So, in the meantime, after that, I go to the ophthalmologist and for the alignment. And so he examines her eyes again and says, it's gone, the blood clot. And so he ends up doing the alignment and the prism. Now, he writes this prescription. Now, should I stick with their eye center, or would they be able to go to where she liked her frames? Would they be able to go to that prescription?
Any optical should be able to take that prescription and put it in her current frames. I think the important question when you're asking about whether prism is necessary or not, at any time of the day, does your wife have double vision? When she's fatigued, does she have any symptoms?
No double vision.
No double vision at any time during the day?
No. No, she doesn't.
When she's driving late at night, when she's watching a late night movie on television, no double vision. If she has no symptoms, then the, quote, need for the prism is largely academic between you and me.
I see. Now,
if she has no symptoms, it would be double vision that is the main reason that one needs to have that prism in the glasses. That's where it's really helping you. Otherwise, it's theoretical, it's academic, probably not so important. Bottom line is, from what you've described to me, I think it doesn't matter. Let her go to her favorite optical. I'm sure they're more than competent to either put that prism in there or not, because it does not sound like she desperately needs it.
I see. And so, real quick, is always your diagnosis that the reading ability of glasses is the same on both eyes?
If I understood the exact words, no, reading ability is not necessarily the same. You know, if it's going to be very individual. You would hope it would be symmetrical, but it may well not.
My wife's are not, as you
exactly
well know.
So it depends on the health of every component of that complex structure we call the eye. So it really is very individual and depends on your wife.
I see. So that's what, the last time she got glasses, it's almost 2.5 years ago, she gets them, and I go, are you going to hem a line? Not a line, but, you know, kind of like fit in her face and everything. And she says, no, I'm fine, and blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, a month later, she says, you know, I can't even read with these glasses. I'm going, what?
Well, that was exactly the situation that I described. It could be the prescription is wrong, but in the vast majority of cases that I see, it's incorrect manufacture of the glasses, so the patient doesn't have access to the reading part of the lens.
And let me just say this, because we're going to have to move on to many other callers here. Charlie, here's one key point. Northwest Vision Institute is in Bellevue and Totem Lake, kind of east side-ish.
Yes.
And it's not like your grocery store, where your grocery store, you need to have it, because you go to the grocery store all the time, you know, and you need to live within 5 miles
or so.
Fuji
apples or Fuji apples, wherever you buy them.
That's right. But when it comes to your eyes, I know you live in Buckley. Well, Totem Lake, you don't have to pack a suitcase. You can make it. And I would tell anybody listening, as we say thank you, Charlie, for your call today, anybody listening, do you think your eyes are important enough to have somebody who is truly on the leading edge, that has passed the test of Dr. Jerry Mixon, for one thing, passing my test, maybe not so impressive, but I'm very happy. And my wife, my kids, my relatives, a neighbor or two and what have you, I am serious about this. Being on the leading edge and seeing the tests and the things that you do in your experience. Trust me, folks, in my opinion, you're nuts if you don't go for the best, especially with your eyes. I mean, come on. So here's what you need to do. You call and make an appointment for Dr. Michael Gilbert. And here's his number, 425-450-2020. 425-450-2020. You can even make your own appointment with this guy right here, Dr. Gilbert, by going to nwvision.com. nwvision.com. I suggest you do it. And with that, let's go to Edmonds and talk with Bonnie.
Bonnie, good morning, Bonnie.
Glad you are with us.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. First of all, I want to say that I was just in to see Dr. Gilbert a couple of weeks ago, and I have a follow-up little surgery Tuesday with Dr. Gilbert.
Great.
Exciting.
Yes, and as I said before, he's like new school, where the first ophthalmologist in Evans I went to was old school, and he did, you know, you've heard me before. His praises, because he does a great job, and everybody in his clinic are just so wonderful, and they're all do such a great job at testing, and he does so much more testing than the ophthalmologist I went to in Edmonds. I mean, it was just incredible.
Well, let me ask you a question, Bonnie. Did he pay you to call in this morning?
No, not at all.
My cousin Bonnie.
I'm thrilled with it. And here's the other thing I was just thinking while I was waiting. He costs the same as anybody else. You know, I mean, he takes Medicare. You know, I do my copay just like everybody, you know, any other doctor's visit. And so it's not like he's so great that he can charge, you know, a lot. He doesn't. It's just a normal scale. Now,
okay, he's so great, he probably could charge a lot, and I'll get my business people to work with him in the near future.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. But I want to quickly comment on Mr. Dr. Umat. I called to your show and asked Mrs. Dr. Umat if I could see her husband, and she said yes. And he also... It's the same thing. I went to a ear, nose, and throat specialist. He looked down my throat, said, I thought maybe I had throat cancer because I was getting very hoarse. And he says, no, you don't have throat cancer. And he said, everything looks fine. Sends me away. Well, I wasn't happy with that. So I called Mr. Dr. Umat and made an appointment and went down. And he found a polyp on my vocal cords. He did so much more work and spent so much more time with me, looked me right in the eye. It was just very, very professional, but very helpful. And he actually even gave me a shot behind my ear. I think it was a steroid. I can't remember what kind, but it just went the 100 miles for me. you know, and did so much more than this other one did. And now I know why I'm hoarse. I have a polyp on my vocal cords, which he said is benign, and I want to see you in 2 months. And I felt satisfied. I felt like somebody was listening to me and followed through.
Sunil is a very good doctor and a very nice person, isn't he?
And you're having dinner with him, and
my wife and I are having dinner with both doctors you met, Sunil and Samantha, tonight.
I'm having dinner with him.
No, I am. My wife and I.
No, I know, but he said you're having dinner with him. I said what?
I've never seen such a
gentle, wonderful soul. Seriously.
Unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, Sunil sold out his interest in Northwest Face and has gone over to the university to take up a research position.
Yes, but he did see me. And I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled with Dr. Gilbert and Dr. Mr. Umat.
Bonnie, do you mind my asking, if I remember, you're having a laser procedure on Tuesday, are you not?
It's the film after my cataract surgery.
Right. I think you're going to be very pleased. Most usually that procedure takes about 15 seconds of laser. You should notice the difference overnight. And the most exciting part is once that's done, that should never come back.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure I'll be very pleased with that. But the only complaint I have is that, you know, this other lady that called in earlier, go for it. There's nothing to worry about. The only complaint is I have to have a driver.
Oh, well.
You know, I have to tell you, that's state law. That's not me.
I know. And I'm speaking, I know I could do it myself. I don't need to bother anybody to drive me there and back. But
I have to tell you, I have been allowing patients to drive home for literally decades after that laser procedure. However, by state law, we're not allowed to do that if we want to retain our licensure.
Well, that's probably a good idea for you.
So oftentimes, as any physician knows, it isn't necessarily just our training and our experience that guides how we deliver medicine.
It's what the government permits us to do.
That's right.
Dr.
Mixon, if we started, he would have a longer story than I about government control and the impact on medicine. So we all live under that.
Yes, we do.
Well, Bonnie, this is certainly nice of you to call in. And
thank you for calling. Please call every time I'm on.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'd want to tell that lady I would never hesitate to go see Dr. Gilbert, ever.
All right.
It's an easy-peasy situation.
With that, Bonnie, you are a total joy. And with that, I need to say, folks, if you're listening to Bonnie or the show today, both, you just simply need to call his office, Northwest Vision Institute, at 425-450-2020. Like she said, you cost the same. It's the same freaking thing.
Most of my colleagues are government-controlled utilities, right?
Unfortunately.
And so,
and most physicians chafe under it all.
Yes. And like I said, you don't. If you live within 2 or 3 hours of Bellevue or Kirkland, or excuse me, Bellevue or Totem Lake, for crying out loud, get the best. They are your eyes.
I do have patients who have flown in from Korea, from Florence, Italy, from, you know, I have patients from all over the world. So patients who call from Buckley, I'm thinking, you don't have to pack a bag.
That's right. Again, the number for Northwest Vision Institute is, where is it here? 425-450-2020. Or just go online right now and make your own appointment at nwvision.com. Okay, Centralia, that's where we're headed next.
Exciting.
Pam, not too far, an hour and a half south.
Okay.
Pam, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for going to listen to me for just a couple minutes. I think on your screen it probably talks about I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation a couple years ago, started taking Eliquis, the recommended blood, I'm going to call it blood thinner, even though it's not exactly, but, and have had no problems with it, but recently was given an article because I was always, have always been apprehensive because there is no antidote for Eliquis or the other, whatever those type of drugs are called, until recent, well, a couple of years ago, one called Andexanet. And the article that was given to me said, do not use this, that the FDA, whoever had passed this and said it's okay to use, didn't do enough testing. So I'm very nervous about the fact that if I take Eliquis, which I am currently taking, and something were to happen where I started bleeding internally, how are they going to stop it? And then the part for Dr. Michael Gilbert is, I have a friend whose son is going through optician school. He saw me and said, what happened to your eye? And I said, well, I don't know. I just woke up and I had this blood in my eye. Didn't hurt, no problem. And it went away after 4 or 5 days. I went to my optician. He looked at it and he said, Pam, it's not uncommon. Told me what, where the blood was in between two layers and talked to me a little bit about it. But the young man who's going to school down in Houston said, you need to ask whether or not your Eliquis that you are taking, maybe if something needs to be adjusted or you need to talk to them about it. So since you're there today, Dr. Gilbert, and Dr. Mixon is there, I thought we could, you could tell me a little bit more about Eliquis, the antidote. Is it something to worry about? Is my eye, 2 times of blood in my eye, anything to be concerned with? And should I just go back or go on to warfarin, which I understand, I know all of the, what you have to do. You have to test. You, it's the old school stuff. It's not the new stuff. But what should I do? That's my question.
Okay. Well, part of this I can do and part of it.
I think you probably have both, but.
Yeah. well, not about the blood in the eye. And there, I think we need to, are we talking about a conjunctival hemorrhage or do we have subconjunctival or, you know, something more serious? If it's conjunctival, if all you did was break a little vessel on the surface of the eye and you get this kind of red eye, looks like, you know, you're a vampire for the afternoon and 2 or 3 days it goes away, I'm not too worried about it. Coumadin, warfarin, sodium warfarin, sold under the brand name Coumadin, has been around since the 1950s. It is the old school. It's an anticoagulant. It was actually developed as a rat poison. You put high doses of it in a sweet, fatty stuff, and the mice and rats eat it, and then they go in the walls and bleed to death.
Okay.
So, yeah. and we discovered that by giving it to humans in lower doses, we can inhibit their clotting, but hopefully not enough that we're going to get them in trouble. But yes, because that the old Coumadin has to be adjusted, and it how effective it is going to depend to a large extent on your diet. If you eat too much in the way of green leafy vegetables, for instance, you will throw your dosing way off. And so, because it's a vitamin K inhibitor. And if you have too much vitamin K, then you need more Coumadin. So it depends on your activity. It depends on your supplements. It depends on your diet. And Eliquis came around, and generally doctors have moved over to that for two reasons. First, the risk of serious bleeding is only 1/4 as high as it is with the Coumadin, with the warfarin. So on sodium warfarin, the old-fashioned one, not only do you need frequent blood tests to adjust your dose and you need to be careful with to keep a consistent diet, etc., you have a 400% higher risk of having a serious bleed than you do with the Eliquis.
That's a darn good reason to consider taking Eliquis.
Now, the problem with the Eliquis is, until more recently, if you did bleed, you were in deep doo-doo because we didn't have a way to reverse it. We've had ways to reverse the bleeding with the Coumadin, so it happened more often, but we could turn it off in a hurry. The Eliquis, mm-hmm. you've only got one-fourth as big a chance of bleeding, but if you did, we had to say, oh, my goodness, we've just got to wait for it to stop. And, you know, that was worrisome. When Eliquis first came out, I had a patient who died from a hemorrhagic stroke on the Eliquis. So, you know, that gave me pause. Fortunately, I didn't put him on the Eliquis. His cardiologist did. So, yeah. But it did have. Now we do have a newer drug that you can reverse Eliquis. Okay. You don't have to just wait for it to stop. And so has that newer drug been tested adequately? I don't really know. I have no reason to think that it was rushed into production, but it's now been out 2 or 3 years, I would think. So it's not new. It's not something that just hit the market. It's been around for several years. So, you know, if your cardiologist is saying use the Eliquis, I'd use the Eliquis. Big downside I see with Eliquis is just the cost.
Yes, the cost is quite high. But so is the cost of the antidote. I have in looking up, it's like from $30,000 to $45,000.
Yeah,
it is the cost, and which my fear is then what hospital is going to be carrying this drug if in fact you need it when I don't know expiration. I don't know any of that. It appears that it's a powder that has to be mixed, and the vials
have to use
a blank amount of vials.
Yeah, and the pharmacy will mix it and so on. The hospital pharmacist is competent to do that. They mix powdered vials all the time.
Now, with this, I'm afraid
hospitals carry this.
I'm afraid
it's so expensive.
Pam, I'm afraid, Pam, we have got to go. We're coming to a hard break in less than a minute.
Talk to your cardiologist. He will know whether or not your local hospital has it.
And with that, a very special thanks to Dr. Michael Gilbert. In fact, I'll tell you what. We've got Dan Nelson, who was supposed to be here from 8 to 9, and he was here. But
we weren't on the air much of the
time. We were not transmitting. So I've asked him to come back, and he's now at the back door.
I'll go get him.
So go get Dan Nelson. We'll have a little crossover here for a few minutes, because I've got another question for you,
great,
Dr. Michael Gilbert.
Perfect.
So, everybody, don't go far. Hour number two here on 570 KVI, coming right up.